Do you know him, Theroux?
Yes.
From when you lived in the camp by the river?
One nod.
Tenar's arms tightened around her. He came here, she said, and all the fears she had felt turned as she spoke into anger, a rage that burned in her the length of her body like a rod of fire. She gave a kind of laugh. Ah! And remembered in that moment Kalesin, how Kalesin had laughed. But it was not so simple for a human and a woman. The fire must be contained, and the child must be comforted. Did he see you?
I hid.
Presently, Tenar said, stroking Theroux's hair, he will never touch you, Theroux. Understand me and believe me. He will never touch you again. He'll never see you again. Unless I'm with you. And then he must deal with me. Do you understand, my dear? My precious, my beautiful? You need not fear him. You must not fear him. He wants you to fear him. He feeds on your fear. We will starve him, Theroux. We'll starve him till he eats himself, till he chokes, gnawing on the bones of his own hands. Don't listen to me now. I'm only angry, only angry. Am I red? Am I red like a Gondish woman now? Like a dragon, am I red? She tried to joke, and Theroux, lifting her head, looked up into her face from her own crumpled, tremulous, fire-eaten face and said, yes, you are a red dragon. The idea of the man's coming to the house, being in the house, coming around to look at his handiwork, maybe thinking of improving on it, that idea, whenever it recurred to Tenar, came less as a thought than as a queasy fit, a need to vomit. But the nausea burned itself out against the anger. They got up and washed, and Tenar decided that what she felt most of all just now was hunger. I am hollow, she said to Theroux, and set them out a substantial meal of bread and cheese, cold beans in oil and herbs, a sliced onion, and dry sausage. Theroux ate a good deal, and Tenar ate a great deal. As they cleared up, she said, for the present, Theroux, I won't leave you at all, and you won't leave me, right? And we should both go now to Auntie Moss's house. She was making a spell to find you, and she needn't bother to go on with it, but she might not know that. Theroux stopped moving. She glanced once at the open doorway and shrank away from it. We need to bring in the laundry, too, on our way back. And when we're back, I'll show you the cloth I got today, for a dress, for a new dress for you, a red dress. The child stood, drawing in to herself. If we hide, Theroux, we feed him. We will eat, and we will starve him. Come with me. The difficulty, the barrier of that doorway to the outside, was tremendous to Theroux. She shrank from it. She hid her face. She trembled, stumbled. It was cruel to force her to cross it, cruel to drive her out of hiding. But Tenar was without pity. Come, she said, and the child came. They walked hand in hand across the fields to Moss's house. Once or twice, Theroux managed to look up. Moss was not surprised to see them, but she had a queer, wary look about her. She told Theroux to run inside her house, to see the ringneck hen's new chicks, and choose which two might be hers. And Theroux disappeared at once into that refuge. She was in the house all along, Tenar said, hiding.
Well, she might, said Moss.
Why? Tenar asked harshly. She was not in the hiding vein.
There's beings about,
the witch said, not pretentiously, but uneasily.
There's scoundrels about, said Tenar, and Moss looked at her and drew back a little. Hey, now, she said. Hey, dearie, you have a fire around you, a shining of fire all about your head. I cast the spell to find the child, but it didn't go right. It went its own way somehow, and I don't know yet if it's ended. I'm bewildered. I saw great beings. I sought the little girl, but I saw them flying in the mountains, flying in the clouds. And now you have that about you, like your hair was afire. What's amiss? What's wrong?
A man in a leather cap, Tenar said. A youngish man, well enough looking. The shoulder seam of his vest's torn.
Have you seen him round?
Moss nodded.
They took him on for the haying at the mansion house.
I told you that she... Tenar glanced at the house. Was with a woman and two men? He's one of them.
You mean one of them that...
Yes. Moss stood like a wood carving of an old woman, rigid, a block.
I don't know, she said at last. I thought I knew enough, but I don't. Would he come to see her?
If he's the father, maybe he's come to claim her.
Claim her?
She's his property. Tenar spoke evenly. She looked up at the heights of Gaunt Mountain as she spoke. But I think it's not the father. I think this is the other one. The one that came and told my friend in the village that the child had hurt herself. Moss was still bewildered, still frightened by her own conjurations and visions, by Tenar's fierceness, by the presence of abominable evil. She shook her head, desolate.
I don't know, she said. I thought I knew enough. How could he come back?
To eat, Tenar said. To eat. I won't be leaving her alone again. But tomorrow, Moss, I might ask you to keep her here an hour or so, early in the day. Would you do that, while I go up to the manor house?
Aye, dearie, of course. I could put a hiding spell on her, if you like. But they're up there, the great men from the King's City.
Why, then, they can see how life is among the common folk, said Tenar. And Moss drew back again, as if from a rush of sparks blown her way from a fire in the wind. Finding words. They were making hay in the Lord's long meadow, strung out across the slope in the bright shadows of morning. Three of the mowers were women, and of the two men, one was a boy, as Tenar could make out from some distance, and the other was stooped and grizzled. She came up along the mown rows and asked one of the women about the man with the leather cap.
"Him from down by Valmouth, ah," said the mower. "Don't know where he's got to."
The others came along the row, glad of a break. None of them knew where the man from Middle Valley was, or why he wasn't mowing with them.
"That kind don't stay," the grizzled man said. "Shiftless. You know him, missus?"
"Not by choice," said Tenar. "He came lurking about my place, frightened the child. I don't know what he's called, even." "Calls himself Handy," the boy volunteered. The others looked at her, or looked away and said nothing. They were beginning to piece out who she must be, the Cargish woman in the old mage's house. They were tenants of the Lord of Realbi, suspicious of the villagers, leery of anything to do with Ogeon. They whetted their scythes, turned away, strung out again, fell to work. Tenar walked down from the hillside field, past a row of walnut trees to the road. On it, a man stood waiting. Her heart leapt. She strode on to meet him. It was Aspen, the wizard of the mansion house. He stood gracefully leaning on his tall pine staff in the shade of a roadside tree. As she came out onto the road, he said,
"Are you looking for work?"
"No."
"My lord needs field hands.
This hot weather's on the turn. The hay must be got in."
To Goha, Flint's widow, what he said was appropriate, and Goha answered him politely. "No doubt your skill can turn the rain from the fields till the hay's in." But he knew she was the woman to whom Ogeon, dying, had spoken his true name. And, given that knowledge, what he said was so insulting and deliberately false as to serve as a clear warning. She had been about to ask him if he knew where the man Handy was. Instead, she said,
"I came to say to the overseer here that a man he took on for the haymaking left my village as a thief, and worse. Not one he'd choose to have about the place. But it seems the man's moved on."
She gazed calmly at Aspen until he answered, with an effort,
"I know nothing about these people."
She had thought him, on the morning of Ogeon's death, to be a young man, a tall, handsome youth, with a gray cloak and a silvery staff. He did not look as young as she had thought him, or he was young but somehow dried and withered. His stare and his voice were now openly contemptuous,
And she answered him in Goha's voice, "To be sure, I beg your pardon." She wanted no trouble with him. She made to go on her way back to the village, but Aspen said, "Wait." She waited. "A thief and worse, you say? But slander's cheap, and a woman's tongue worse than any thief. You come up here to make bad blood among the field hands, casting calumny and lies. The dragon seed every witch sows behind her. Did you think I did not know you for a witch when I saw that foul imp that clings to you? Do you think I did not know how it was begotten and for what purposes? The man did well who tried to destroy that creature, but the job should be completed. You defied me once across the body of the old wizard, and I forbore to punish you then for his sake and in the presence of others. But now you've come too far, and I warn you, woman, I will not have you set foot on this domain. And if you cross my will, or dare so much as speak to me again, I will have you driven from Rialbi, and off the Overfell with the dogs at your heels. Have you understood me?" "No," Tenar said. "I have never understood men like you." She turned and set off down the road. Something like a stroking touch went up her spine, and her hair lifted up on her head. She turned sharp round to see the wizard reach out his staff towards her, and the dark lightnings gather round it, and his lips part to speak. She thought in that moment, "Because Ged has lost his majory, I thought all men had, but I was wrong." And a civil voice said, "Well, well, what have we here?" Two of the men from Havnar had come out onto the road from the cherry orchards on the other side of it. They looked from Aspen to Tenar with bland and courtly expressions, as if regretting the necessity of preventing a wizard from laying a curse on a middle-aged widow. But really, really, it would not do. "Mistress Goha," said the man with the gold-embroidered shirt, and bowed to her. The other, the bright-eyed one, saluted her also, smiling. "Mistress Goha," he said, "is one who, like the king, bears her true name openly, I think, and unafraid. Living in Gaunt, she may prefer that we use her Gauntish name. But knowing her deeds, I ask to do her honor, for she wore the ring that no woman wore since Elfaran." He dropped to one knee, as if it were the most natural thing in the world, took Tenar's right hand very lightly and quickly, and touched his forehead to her wrist. He released her and stood up, smiling that kind, collusive smile. "Ah," said Tenar, flustered and warmed right through. "There's all kinds of power in the world. Thank you." The wizard stood motionless, staring. He had closed his mouth on the curse and drawn back his staff, but there was still a visible darkness about it and about his eyes. She did not know whether he had known or had just now learned that she was Tenar of the Ring. It did not matter. He could not hate her more. To be a woman was her fault. Nothing could worsen or amend it in his eyes. No punishment was enough. He had looked at what had been done to Theru and approved. "Sir," she said now to the older man, "anything less than honesty and openness seems dishonor to the king for whom you speak and act as now. I'd like to honor the king and his messengers, but my own honor lies in silence until my friend releases me. I'm sure, my lords, that he'll send some word to you in time. Only give him time, I pray you." "Surely," said the one, and the other, "as much time as he wants. And your trust, my lady, honors us above all." She went on down the road to Rialbi at last, shaken by the shock and change of things, the wizard's flaying hatred, her own angry contempt, her terror at the sudden knowledge of his will and power to do her harm, the sudden end of that terror in the refuge offered by the envoys of the king. The men who had come in the white-sailed ship from the haven itself, the tower of the sword and the throne, the center of right and order. Her heart lifted up in gratitude. There was indeed a king upon that throne, and in his crown, the chiefest jewel would be the rune of peace. She liked the younger man's face, clever and kindly, and the way he had knelt to her as to a queen, and his smile that had a wink hidden in it. She turned to look back. The two envoys were walking up the road to the mansion house with the wizard Aspen. They seemed to be conversing with him amicably, as if nothing had happened. That sank her surge of hopeful trust a bit. To be sure, they were courtiers. It wasn't their business to quarrel or to judge and disapprove. And he was a wizard, and their host's wizard. Still, she thought, they needn't have walked and talked with him quite so comfortably. The men from Havnar stayed several days with the Lord of Realbi, perhaps hoping that the Archmage would change his mind and come to them. But they did not seek him, nor press Tenar about where he might be. When they left at last, Tenar told herself that she must make up her mind what to do. There was no real reason for her to stay here, and two strong reasons for leaving. Aspen and Handy, neither of whom could she trust to let her and Theru alone. Yet she found it hard to make up her mind, because it was hard to think of going. In leaving Realbi now, she left Ogeon, lost him, as she had not lost him while she kept his house and weeded his onions. And she thought, I will never dream of the sky down there. Here, where Kalesin had come, she was Tenar, she thought. Down in Middle Valley, she would only be Goha again. She delayed. She said to herself, am I to fear those scoundrels, to run from them? That's what they want me to do. Are they to make me come and go at their will? She said to herself, I'll just finish the cheese-making. She kept Theru always with her, and the days went by. Moss came with a tale to tell. Tenar had asked her about the wizard Aspen, not telling her the whole story, but saying that he had threatened her, which, in fact, might well be all he had meant to do. Moss usually kept clear of the old lord's domain, but she was curious about what went on there, and not unwilling to find the chance to chat with some acquaintances there, a woman from whom she had learned midwifery, and others whom she had attended as healer or finder. She got them talking about the doings at the mansion house. They all hated Aspen, and so were quite ready to talk about him. But their tales must be heard as half spite and fear. Still, there would be facts among the fancies. Moss herself attested that until Aspen came 3 years ago, the younger lord, the grandson, had been fit and well, though a shy, sullen man. Scared-like, she said. Then, about the time the young lord's mother died, the old lord had sent to Roke for a wizard. What for? With Lord Ogeon not a mile away, and they're all witch-folk themselves in the mansion. But Aspen had come. He had paid his respects, and no more, to Ogeon, and always, Moss said, stayed up at the mansion. Since then, less and less had been seen of the grandson, and it was said now that he lay day and night in bed, like a sick baby, all shriveled up, said one of the women who had been into the house on some errand. But the old lord, 100 years old or near or more, Moss insisted. She had no fear of numbers and no respect for them. The old lord was flourishing, full of juice, they said. And one of the men, for they would have only men wait on them in the mansion, had told one of the women that the old lord had hired the wizard to make him live forever, and that the wizard was doing that, feeding him, the man said, off the grandson's life. And the man saw no harm in it, saying, who wouldn't want to live forever? Well, Tenar said, taken aback, that's an ugly story. Don't they talk about all this in the village? Moss shrugged. It was a matter of let be again. The doings of the powerful were not to be judged by the powerless, and there was the dim, blind loyalty, the rootedness in place. The old man was their lord, Lord of Realbi. Nobody else's business what he did. Moss evidently felt this herself. Risky, she said. Bound to go wrong. Such a trick. But she did not say it was wicked. No sign of the man Handy had been seen up at the mansion. Longing to be sure that he had left the Overfell, Tenar asked an acquaintance or two in the village if they had seen such a man, but she got unwilling and equivocal replies. They wanted no part of her affairs. Let be. Only old Fan treated her as a friend and fellow villager. And that might be because his eyes were so dim he could not clearly see Theru. She took the child with her now when she went into the village, or any distance at all from the house. Theru did not find this bondage wearisome. She stayed close by Tenar, as a much younger child would do, working with her or playing.